Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we have Daniel Skarnecchia on the show to talk about the intersection of technology and humanitarianism. So first of all, thank you for coming on the show, Daniel, and you're a new guest to the Loopcast.
Yes, I am. Well, thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to this. And let's pick up wherever you would like me to pick up.
For our listeners, I will give you a little idea of who Daniel is. He is a researcher that focuses on the role of technology and how it plays in humanitarian crises and responses. He was most recently with the Harvard Humanitarian Initiative's Signal program on human security and technology, where he focused primarily on standards, ethics, and governance of technology and humanitarian responses. He also has worked on projects looking at the role of disinformation in the Syrian conflict, and he has co-authored a handful of pieces, including a report called The Signal Code, A Human Rights Approach to Information During Crises, and Ethical Obligations for Humanitarian Information Activities. So he's the perfect person for this topic, and I'm, like I said, very happy that you're on the show, Dan. So we wanted you to come on the Loopcast because you had a piece recently in Medium that was great. And in it, you state that today we are at the moment of rapid technological change. Digital technologies are affecting our societies and politics in unprecedented ways, and the institutions with which safeguard our society are just beginning to grapple with implications. So why don't you discuss this? Because this is a very powerful statement that you start off with, and we'd love to jump into it here on the Loopcast.
Sure. So it's kind of a broad sentence and deliberately so. And I'll tell you a little bit of how I came to it initially, which is, of course, the work that I've been doing has primarily been focused on the role of technology in humanitarian response. And the concept of digital humanitarianism has been around for a while. It started with this idea, of course, it didn't necessarily start, but it became popular with this idea of crisis mapping, really around the 2011 Haiti earthquake. And the role of technology in humanitarian response has grown over the years, of course, as technology has become sort of a broad part of all of our lives. There's, especially when we're talking about, I should clarify that when I say technology, I really mean digital technology, digital information and communications technology, because technology is really how you do anything. But the distinction is important because digital technology has really changed the way we function as organizations and as societies in terms of our relationship with information. And that's continuing to change with the sort of advent and diffusion of social media into our society. And so we initially came to this, of course, looking at how humanitarian organizations were using technology. And broadly speaking, of course, the idea of digital technology as a way to improve efficiency was driving the discourse. And, for good reason, in an era where you have a large number of humanitarian crises, more refugees since the end of World War II, and, of course, shrinking budgets. But what often got left out of that conversation, of course, was the sort of rights of the crisis affected. There was generally a focus on how these could help us, a general sense of techno-optimism, but no real focus on things like how it would affect the privacy and security of individuals who were affected by crisis, how we were really understanding the risks associated with these technologies as organizations. Again, while the private sector is usually regulated, we can argue about how well they're regulated, but they're usually regulated in various degrees by states. The humanitarian sector, of course, works across states. Large organizations like the UN organizations, other international organizations usually have some degree of privileges and immunities, meaning that, that either broad rights regimes on the regional level or state law doesn't necessarily apply to those activities. And then, of course, smaller NGOs don't necessarily have the capacity to either engage in compliance activities or to simply sort of implement information technology in a professional way. Now, that has been changing, and I don't want to be overly critical, but that's sort of how we came to this. Now, looking at all of this, and of course, through the course of my work, I also got engaged on humanitarian disinformation, and I have colleagues that are doing other work on how technology and really things like mobile technology are affecting the crisis affected, you know, the IDPs, the refugees, people who live in conflict and disaster zones. And what we sort of realized, of course, was that because we were so focused on how technology might benefit or improve sort of the efficiency of our work, we didn't really have an understanding of how, one, that technology was related to individuals who were affected by crisis, but also how they were using technology themselves. And so, for example, my colleague Danny Poole, who is a PhD candidate at the School of Public Health here, has done a lot of her doctoral work on how refugees coming out of the Syrian crisis are using mobile phones, and in particular looking at how it's affecting things like mental health outcomes. And so she's talked to refugees and done surveys with refugees in Greece, Syrian refugees. And you have to remember that this was a society that before the conflict had, in the urban areas, relatively good diffusion of 3G, you know, mobile phones. So, you know, the paradigm for thinking about how they're relating to technology is pretty much how we relate to technology. It's easy to conjure up, you know, and sort of a historical notion of, you know, a refugee in a camp somewhere who's, you know, dirt poor and doesn't have any material possessions. And that's really, that's a very sort of Western-centric, I should say, sort of almost neocolonial projection of what we think the outside world looks like. Now, especially, across the world, you know, mobile phones are becoming ubiquitous, and then especially in a country that was, you know, a relatively, you know, upper middle income country like Syria before the crisis, you had lots of people who had smartphones already. And what she was looking at, of course, was how access to phones was affecting their mental health outcomes and what the sort of differentiators are. So, for example, prior to her study, we did not really have a good sense of how gender might be affecting how people access mobile phones and then the effects it might have on, say, their mental health. And what she found was that men tend to own phones, and women generally had less access to phones. And she found subsequently that women had much higher rates of moderate to severe depression. And one of the frequently cited reasons was, of course, that they didn't have ready access to phones through which they could, you know, talk to the diaspora, talk to their extended family. And so there's little things like that that are sort of the important bit of doing science around how technology affects individuals, but hadn't been done up until that point. And then the other thing is sort of if that's the micro level of sort of how the technology relates to individuals who are caught up in crisis. The sort of effects on our societies and politics are things that we're just also starting to unpack. And I think, you know, most people listening will be familiar with the discussions around sort of hybrid warfare, disinformation, and these concepts related really to Russian interference in elections in the West. And of course, when we started looking at disinformation ourselves, it was sort of driven by the idea that, you know, okay, we've sort of, you know, there's some anecdotal signals that we're seeing. Let's take a closer look around how this is being used in the Syrian conflict. What's been interesting, of course, about that, and the reason I wrote that piece, is that we often still talk about these as singular events. We don't talk about them through sort of a political science lens or notion of power and politics. And So we tend to lose sight of the ways that the technology is affecting politics globally, and that's the politics within which humanitarian response exists, as in addition to sort of the single cases. So when we look at things like social media, we don't, we are sort of stuck in this moment, or we're in this moment where we're just sort of starting to internalize the ramifications. And of course, we don't fully understand the ramifications. It's sort of something that's still being debated and understood. And in the humanitarian sector, I would argue that we're a bit further behind in that, because again, there's no singular discipline of humanitarian studies. There's a number of different related disciplines which constitute humanitarian studies, and none of them have really gotten to the point where they've had to focus on grappling with sort of the societal changes fostered by technology.
And that was actually one of my questions, that this focus on singular cases is an issue. And I was wondering if you could discuss the implications of that. And what does it mean for the broad study of humanitarianism and new emerging technologies?
Well, and I'm going to argue that it's going to depend a little bit on the type of technology. But when it comes to, say, things like social media, and that we're starting to see, social media in the sense that it's sort of being used as an instrument of power, for example. You have a few different ways in which that is happening. You have sort of the use case, in Myanmar, where you all of a sudden have, 30 million people online, or perhaps even more, online in the last 5 years, who really prior to that didn't have access to mobile technology of any sort. I believe in 2012, 2011 or 2012, there were, fewer than 10,000 SIM cards in Myanmar. And now you have a society, I think it's 60 million, and I think 44 million people are connected, and 30 million are on Facebook or something of that nature. And so, of course, it's a society that's transitioning between autocratic rule and democracy, and that of course is where societies are usually the least stable and can veer one way or the other. And you have a number of ethnic minorities across the country, and what it sort of seems like what has happened with sort of the proliferation of Facebook via Free Basics is we've seen a conscious effort on the part of the military to spread rumors and paint the Rohingya as the enemy of Myanmar society. And this is all everybody had a sense it was happening, and you can certainly, there's room to debate the effects that the technology had versus sort of the other effects, the other causes of violence in a society. I don't want to be completely prescriptivist and say that, it is only the technology. But the technology introduces some new complications. Things like social media really do change our relationship with information. There's some really good work. I mean, it goes back 40 years at this point, looking at how information spreads through social networks. And of course, when you increase the density of sort of weak ties or bridging ties, which is, people who are not necessarily in your close periphery, but they're sort of people who you would, go to for, to say find a job, or who would link together different, activist groups. Information, they bring new information into your group that wouldn't come in otherwise. Most of your novel information comes through those ties, because most of your close friends already know everything that you're going to be talking about. It's the mechanism by which then new ideas flow in. So social media does a lot of things, and one of the things it does do is introduce it makes it easier to introduce new information into sort of discrete groups, and it does that in part by visualizing the weak ties. So it can turn latent ties into weak ties, latent ties are those sort of ones that exist mathematically, but they haven't been activated. And in this case, once they become activated, if it increases that density, it's increasing the amount of new information people are exposed to. And so in a society like Myanmar, although I would argue that this is also happening here because, you know, we like to talk about digital literacy, but at the end of the day, you know, we see how we tend to, as a society, share plenty of fake news, and I hate the term fake news, but disinformation and misinformation. And so, you know, of course, when that's put to the ends of violence, it reaches a whole lot of people a lot more quickly than, say, a broadcast medium like radio might. And so that might be changing the effects of power dynamics within states in ways that, you know, increase political tensions, cause ethnic violence or drive ethnic violence, and allow political actors within those states to just, for, you know, for their own ends, further those aims. On the international scale, and I think that this is when we look at Syria and a lot of the work that we've done there, this is what this is where I tend to sort of move away from the discussion of talking about it as a singular set of cases and avoid talking about it in terms of warfare, because if you go to the political science literature, and I know Dan Nexon and Stacey Goddard have done a lot of work on sort of the tools of statecraft, and they sort of point to social media as sort of a new phenomenon in the sense that it's a new technology. It's becoming part of an old struggle, and it gives states, potentially gives states, new ways of engaging in that, but it is not introducing anything new in terms of what states are doing. And so they're, what states, of course, are doing is engaging in traditional power politics. And, well, I should say states are doing it, but also plenty of non-state actors are doing it. And you're, of course, much more familiar with how non-state actors like ISIS, you know, might be using these technologies to sort of increase recruitment and further their power. It's a tool of propaganda. It's a tool that's used essentially to fracture the sort of social cohesion necessary within rival societies to counter an activity. So, you know, Russia might be using it in Syria. Maybe not even in particular, you know, a lot of the disinformation that we see there is focused on the White Helmets. But, you know, the why of the White Helmets is always a salient question. Now, I suspect it's because they have GoPros and they're documenting evidence of atrocities. And while we have plenty of, you know, third parties credibly reporting that the atrocities, you know, the sarin gas attacks were committed predominantly by, and chlorine gas for that matter too, were committed by regime forces. If you can call that into question, it makes it much, it's sort of a tool of deterrence. And by deterrence, I mean, it makes it harder for states like the US, like the UK to comprehensively, you know, strike back when somebody violates international law. And it makes it sort of politically more difficult to prosecute these crimes, you know, later, if you have, say, large political constituencies in states that would normally be driving war crimes prosecutions that think that the attacks are actually false flag, because at the end of the day, politicians are really, they're, at least in the West, where we have democracies, beholden to populations and their political constituencies. So that's always... you know, that's what I mean by sort of disrupting sort of social cohesion, is it sort of drives all these factors which make it much more difficult to deter, say, violations of international law. And of course, what that means for humanitarian response is we are ostensibly neutral and impartial actors. Now, the politics of humanitarianism is much more complicated than that. But you do have organizations like the ICRC, which are sort of rigidly and deliberately impartial. And, you know, they talk to both sides. They provide aid to all sides. But the way that these, you know, the rhetoric that we're seeing around these technology, of course, is, you know, taking shape, is it's designed to call into question even some of that impartiality. You know, a lot of the White Helmet stuff and the Syria stuff, it sort of grew out of skepticism of Western motives around intervention. but it paints it with a broad, very broad brush, because it isn't intended to be nuanced. It's sort of intended to paint everything as cover for, say, Western intervention in the conflict. And so as humanitarians, when a technology comes along that changes sort of that social or that political milieu on the international level in which we exist, I think it's important that we start to understand and internalize that, because otherwise we're sort of, one, operating in the dark in terms of the risks to ourselves, and then two, we're being acted against by actors within the conflict that want to instrumentalize aid and make it part of the conflict. And then finally, it makes it harder to uphold the political norms and the sort of legal norms, which really both protect civilians, protect humanitarians, and drive the idea of humanitarian response as a thing that can exist in the international political order.
Are humanitarian organizations aware of this use of information for, whether it's spreading disinformation or spreading a specific narrative, are they aware of it, and are they starting to create measures to either counter it or keep their workers aware so that individuals that are going to countries where there are potential conflicts, or some of the countries you've just mentioned and discussed, that they're aware of the situation, they have the information that they need to operate on the ground and help people, which that's pretty much what they're there to do, not get involved in all the politics of what's taking place?
You know, I think to a certain extent, yes, and to a certain extent, no, which is not a particularly satisfying answer. You know, one thing we have to, of course, remember is that rumor has always been part of humanitarianism. And we do a lot to try and, you know, I know Internews, for example, has done a lot to try and dispel the spread of rumors, especially the kind of rumors that spread among refugees and can cause, cause them harm. On the sort of broader political side, there's also, of course, always going to be political actors within states that are going to be trying to instrumentalize response, or, you know, they will look for a reason to throw out humanitarian actors. Now, traditionally with humanitarian response, humanitarians have to be invited in by the government that's recognized as sovereign. It's not the sort of thing where you can go in and just start delivering aid. And so in Syria, for example, one of the problems you encountered was that from the get-go, you end up being instrumentalized there because you are only allowed to access territory held by the Syrian Arab government, so Assad's government. They made it much more difficult to access rebel-held territory. And so that's why you have organizations like groups like the White Helmets spring up and get funded by, you know, outside actors in order to, you know, essentially they are providing those services as best they can within those territories that we're not allowed access to. And that, of course, is, you know, one of the perils of civil conflict. You know, there's a debate, of course, as to sort of how far the right to humanitarian aid extends, within the sort of legal and academic literature. And as you know, the Geneva Conventions were written in, 1949, and, the additional protocols came about in 1977, and only one of the additional protocols really deals with civil conflict within a state as opposed to international conflict. And so the legal tools that we have to sort of even start thinking about delivering aid to sort of rebel-held territories are a lot more limited than you might have with an internationalized or an international conflict. And then, of course, where that gets kind of sticky and interesting and challenging is, of course, you also have humanitarianism that is driven by states. So the U.S. has USAID, of course, and USAID does a lot of work around the world. That's really good work. But they're also limited because they're much, their hands are tied in some ways by U.S. law a lot more than, say, the ICRC would be. And in some ways, you could argue that that instrumentalizes aid, too. And this is not at all related to technology. This is just politics. So, for example, when you look at Afghanistan, the reason that, you know, MSF and the ICRC are the groups that are primarily providing aid in Taliban-held territory is because they are political actors that have a neutral relationship with all parties, as opposed to a lot of NGOs that might be close to DFID, which is the UK's sort of version of USAID, or USAID, who are, you know, their hands are tied by material support laws, and their hands are tied by the risks associated with being perceived as being close to a specific set of parties' conflict or parties to the conflict. Now, again, like I said, that's politics. That's not technology. But this is why where it gets a little complicated is, of course, when we start talking about social media, for example, and the sort of macro scale kind of politics associated with it, you know, the tools that you need are not necessarily technological ones. They're really very much political tools. And, you know, if you're an actor who's already on the ground, if you're an international actor, the odds of you actually going someplace in one of those conflicts where you're going to be sort of in danger are relatively low, to say what local actors will be experiencing anyway. And so the sort of duty of care to inform people about the risks associated with, say, a certain type of technology changing the political landscape is something that varies and is probably not too well articulated, because, you know, we have had some recent cases about sort of the duty of care that NGOs owe to their employees. You have some recent, I don't want to say scandals, but the news stories around that when it comes to the UN. And of course, when it comes to technology, we're still trying to figure out what our duty of care is to whom. And when you come to some of those larger political problems, I think that calculus is not necessarily going to be associated with technology. And so when organizations become aware of it is when it becomes a political risk, or when it does become a personnel risk, but at a political level and not sort of at a technological level. If that makes sense.
No, that makes complete sense. And would you say that there are things available through technology that could actually help the humanitarian cause and organizations, and what might those be?
Absolutely. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's the same sets of technologies. Social media is a fantastic advocacy tool. A lot of the reason that technology, you know, digital information communications technology has been so eagerly adopted by the humanitarian sector is both for efficiency's sake, but because it does have other benefits like improving situational awareness. A lot of the challenges over the last several years have been, of course, you know, the sort of experimental nature of playing with new technologies. So you're using new technologies to try and improve response in places where human lives are at stake. And you have to be very careful that you're not, in, for say, the sake of innovation, engaging in human subjects experimentation. That is one of the major challenges in the sector. I think we've focused too much on newness and on, you know, trying to improve things with technology, and not enough on the rights of individuals and the affected. But if I were to say that, you know, when it comes to technology, you essentially are talking about a set of tools that the ICRC called it, I'm blanking on what they called it, but it's essentially a paradox, because there are sets of tools. WhatsApp, for example, is, again, becoming fairly ubiquitous. It's the tool that a lot of people already used in Syria to communicate. And so now that, there's a conflict and, it can help them, because it can help them find safety. But it can also be used to harm them. The metadata coming out of messaging apps can be used to cause harm. The biometrics that we're starting to employ in refugee camps, the idea, of course, there was around efficiency and improving response and making sure that people were getting the aid that they were entitled to. It was also designed to, of course, do things like reduce fraud, which is an interesting thing. I don't know if you really want to be looking at beneficiaries through a sort of adversarial lens like that, but I, of course, understand why organizations are concerned about that from the perspective of donors being concerned about it. That being said, those technologies, you know, can also be used to very easily track people. And you we already have the concept of personally identifiable information, of course, where you can, with a lot of these technologies, re-identify people. You know, anonymization is not something that's particularly robust anywhere. And then, of course, you know, when you're dealing with especially conflict settings or even in disaster settings where you have, you know, racial or ethnic tensions, you have the risks of you know, those technologies being used to, you know, determine people's ethnicity. And for, so the state, you know, the state power, the powers that, you know, be are, you know, have ways to sort of weaponize that same technology that an aid organization might be using to try and help people.
And considering all of this, there's been a huge debate, of course, in my research field of radicalization and radical content online and how tech companies and social media companies should or shouldn't be responsible for things disseminated on their platforms. So looking at it from the lens of what we're talking about, what are your thoughts on the role of tech and social media companies in all of this?
So that's a really difficult question to answer because I think what we end up doing is we end up having a conversation about regulation a lot of the time. And it's, you know, and it is a very difficult space to regulate for a number of reasons. And I think, you know, while I often disagree with some of, you know, with his conclusions, I think Alex Stamos does a good job of pointing out, who's, you know, Facebook's former head of security, does a good job of pointing out the challenges associated with regulation. And regulation, of course, often has unintended consequences. You know, it is one of those things that it can give states more control, say, vis-a-vis activists. We see that with a lot of fake news legislation. It's being used as an excuse to crack down on dissent in states that, you know, don't necessarily have the best human rights records to begin with. But on the other hand, by not regulating technology, there's a couple of things that I think happen. And one is very deliberate on the part of Silicon Valley, which is that free speech is the only human right. You know, coming from my perspective, you know, and you know, being a big advocate for a rights-based approach to how we deal with technology, of course, there are far more rights than, you know, are provided. There's far more than just freedom of speech or freedom of expression that matter. You know, and privacy is obviously one of them, and you can argue about whether privacy can be, you know, sort of suspended during things like national emergencies. I mean, when you look at international law, there are ways to abrogate certain rights, but there are certain rights that are completely unalienable. When we look at, you know, and the right to security and security of person is one, for example. And the question that we need to start asking, of course, is when we look at technology, and we take a free speech sort of over everything else approach, what are the rights that we are then sort of diminishing? You know, historically, privacy, for example, and freedom of speech are held in tension. And of course, those tensions are litigated out, and they're really compromised solutions. And that's how we govern societies. And, you know, I think in the 21st century, we're starting to realize that it's not just a tension. There's not just a tension between, say, free speech and privacy, but there's a tension between free speech and security of person that we're also just starting to deal with, especially as these technologies both provide major benefits to human society, but also have the potential, and in some cases are demonstrably causing serious harm to society. And then, of course, you know, when it comes to things like conflict settings in particular. You have, international humanitarian law, especially with international conflicts, you have the rules of war governing that. You also, the rules of war do govern, civil conflict as well. But the rights there that, of course, protect civilians, it's to limit the effects of total war. And there's no space in which, of course, IHL gets litigated out. There's no court that deals with it, except for, special tribunals that may get set up when, atrocities have been committed. I think one of the things that we ran into, of course, when we were, say, looking at Syria is, how do you define, a group like the White Helmets? They're not traditional humanitarians. They're not the recognized, say, civil defense force of Syria, but they're civilians. And there are very specific ways in which those rules are applied towards civilians. Those rules, and how you interpret who is an armed actor and who is a civilian. And especially in a conflict that is one where you have a lot of non-state actors. And so one of the ways these technologies are being used, of course, is in an attempt to claim that the White Helmets are terrorists and that they are legitimate targets. And it's a really interesting space because you run into what's happening is essentially some of that is state actors, but some of it's legitimate political speech by people who think that this is a cover for, Western intervention. And so how you regulate a situation like that where they're promoting a falsehood because they're not lawyers, and I'll caveat this by the fact that I'm not a lawyer either. And so when we talk about international law, we all tend to lose sight of there's a lot of complications and nuance with any body of law that has an internal set, a sort of internal logic. And so we're not really playing in the area of law. What we are doing is playing in the area of politics when we have a lot of those arguments online. And so by advocating for the fact that these people, the White Helmets are legitimate targets, you're really engaging in a political discourse that's a little bit divorced from the reality of what the law says. And when, people are doing that because they, hold a political belief, and they are misinformed, that's arguably legitimate political speech. And how you deal with that is very different than how you deal with someone like, how you deal with Sputnik or RT or, frankly, if we're being intellectually honest, things like, Voice of America fall into sort of similar state media. And then there's state actors, which are clearly just propaganda that are, not declaring themselves as being associated with, say, media. They, when it comes to, we saw this all about, all around the U.S. elections, of course, with how, Russian intelligence was driving a lot of these conversations as well. And, the colleagues that I've done work with on the Syria example have done some further work looking on how specific narratives emerge. And it's very, very hard to sort of argue that it's something that's completely driven by, say, a single state actor. Because what you actually end up seeing are sort of collaborative spaces where networks of individuals and activists, state parties, all come together and sort of collaborate around crafting strategic narratives that suit their aims. And they, it's not a cohesive network because people come in, drop out as sort of their political agenda changes, as their advocacy agenda changes. And so I'd be very hard pressed to look at a space like that. And this is actually part of the point, is that when you have a space that messy and complicated, it makes it very difficult to regulate. So that's an advantage to people who want to use the technology to, disrupt the ability for states to sort of respond coherently to things like atrocities. And so I don't have good answers for how we should, regulate it. I do think that social media firms, technology firms in general, do need to take a better they need to have more responsibility for dealing with some of these problems. I mean, there's, of course, the extremely radical idea that, you know, maybe we should be questioning whether these technologies are even good ideas to begin with. And, you know, I don't think you're ever going to unring the bell of, say, social media, but we should pause and think through the unintended consequences of technology before, you know, we sort of wholeheartedly adopt it and, you know, wholesale into our society, if you will. So I'm sorry, that's probably not a very satisfying answer, because there's just, every time I have this conversation about what should be done, you can go down so many different rabbit holes and end up getting to just very either unsatisfying conclusions, or you can end up in places where there are sort of radical unintended consequences that create additional challenges.
I completely agree. It's a very sensitive question and topic. I deal with it myself, and I'm still not sure what end of the spectrum, if there is even an end of the spectrum that I stand on. I think there's many forces involved, so it's hard to just take one stance. Going back to something that you mentioned in the talk about the laws of war and who is considered a civilian or an actor, would you say that potentially with these new technologies and almost a new form of warfare that we're seeing with using technologies, using actual fighting on the ground, etc., and using also narratives to sway conflicts and politics towards or against a certain narrative, would you say that some of the traditional rules and laws that govern conflict should potentially be looked at and adjusted or even changed or things added?
So, yes and no. I'm not going to advocate for changing the law. I'm not going to advocate for, you know, Microsoft has been pushing for the idea of a fifth Geneva Convention. I think there are risks inherent to any revising or adding new laws at this point, because, you know, you have to recall, of course, that states will, during that drafting process, take advantage of it as they can, and we may not like the outcomes. And, you know, the current set of conventions came about in a period following the end of World War II, and they were contentious enough, but that, you know, there was a real need, and there was a real moment of sort of systems change occurring, where a new, you know, a new global order was coalescing around, you know, a set of powers. And I think that, not to say that that's a completely unique point in history, but I think that, you know, the sort of lobbying and advocacy and required to do that does take sort of a special time and a unique set of circumstances. And that's not to say that we haven't achieved things in international law since, but I would be wary of essentially now, when we're at a moment of increasing, you know, multipolarity again, and you have lots of revisionism, opening the door to weakening the existing sets of rules and laws. What I do think is necessary, and my colleagues and I have, you know, every chance that we've had, you know, where we've been on stage with, you know, high level folks from the International Committee for the Red Cross, which is, you know, shocking to me, but we have had the privilege to sort of be in these discussions, you know, press for a commentary. What we do need essentially is clarification about how existing law and the existing rules of war apply. And, I mean, I think that there are a lot of cases where it's pretty cut and dry. I mean, you know, the ICRC is a great example of an organization that, you know, they tend not to, unless things are really bad, condemn any actors publicly. They make private entreaties to remind warring parties of their obligations under the law. And a lot of what we've just been talking about with technology, when it comes to rights and when it comes to sort of non-IHL sort of lenses, and you're looking at sort of what you see. A lot of these are happening outside the conflict zone. They're not part of the, what is considered that, they're not happening in a territory that is conflicted. So IHL doesn't apply. And but when, of course, you have warring parties that are engaging in, now those warring parties, their activities can potentially be policed. And under the existing law, I'm, again, not an IHL lawyer, so I would recommend talking to one there. But if there were a potential violation, there would be avenues through which, say, the ICRC would be able to go and, again, entreat states and non-state actors to fulfill their obligations under the law. And, of course, there are other mechanisms, you see, that are sort of more ad hoc, but, UN fact-finding missions and reports, and then that are able to sort of publicize, how these technologies may have been used. So again, with Myanmar, we don't have a clear sort of sense of necessarily, well, I should say with Myanmar, Facebook kind of stonewalled, at least according to the UN, they stonewalled that fact-finding mission. But we do have plenty of reporting that shows how the generals, used Facebook to sort of spread the anti-Rohingya message. And as a result, I don't know if you'll see it, but that opens up political room for special tribunals and other sort of accountability mechanisms of that nature. And, accountability is something that is very difficult under international law, but it does exist, if the political will is there and if you can sort of mobilize and get around vetoes. It's not easy, but it is there. There are tools. And so I think that those are the spaces we need to look at, and we need to understand how this sort of nexus of traditional conflict, really, and new technology that is deterritorialized applies when it comes to the sort of existing rules. And then if we sort of look and find shortcomings, that's when we start thinking about, well, how do we politically create the will within the international community to, fill those gaps? Is it even possible at this point in history, or is it going to be? I mean, again, with even the landmine treaty, when you look at how long that took, that was a 50-year effort from the sort of first advocates till it was signed. And so, you do have to think long term, and you also have to think about sort of the political realities and how you go about that advocacy.
So considering that new technologies, especially online technologies, are probably going to progress, we're going to see new ways of communicating and spreading information, and everything that we've talked about so far on this show, I have a final question for you, and that's, what do you think the future holds?
Well, I'm sure if you already follow me on Twitter, you'll note that I'm fairly pessimistic. I think, though, my pessimism isn't necessarily, it is in part born by technology. But if I were to step back, I think that I don't think that technology is neutral. But I do think that technology does have good uses and it does have bad uses. And technology, of course, comes about because of investment in those technologies. And so you could argue that, Facebook was not inevitable. Facebook became inevitable because there were ways to monetize it and financialize it. And so the role of technology should be understood, because as I've been talking about throughout the show, I think that technology changes our relationship with information. It has that ability to create, for political actors to take advantage of it and create new political settlements, if you will. But we shouldn't we shouldn't step away and say it's only technology. We should step away and remind ourselves that it's not just technology. There are plenty of other factors that drive how technology is developed, how it's regulated. And so, there's obviously the role of capital. There's the role of states in all of that. And we're also at a moment, of course, where the United States is a declining hegemon. And to dive into, I am I'm a bit of a constructivist, but when you sort of buy into the idea that the hegemon, that there's sort of, there is an order within international relations in the sense that you have you states that are subordinate and superordinate to other states and other actors as well. I should say you can throw firms, wealthy individuals, groups like ISIS in there as well. They all compete for power on the international stage. And with, you know, a declining hegemon like the United States, it had set the rules of the road along with, of course, its allies and other powers that were sort of seeking its, you know, its largesse and favor over the years. And as this sort of, you know, the hegemon declines, you have other rising powers. You have China, and you have, of course, Russia, which is revisionist and resurgent. And what all of that amounts to, of course, is that these states all have different political values. And the reason they're revisionist states is in a sense that because the sort of existing global order, the rules have disadvantaged them. And, you know, and frankly, the rules have disadvantaged authoritarian states for the most part. I mean, there's a good reason why states, even authoritarian states, tend to have elections, even if the outcome means that the winner gets 99% of the vote and everybody knows they're not free and fair. They're performing sort of what is expected by the sort of existing rules of the road. What that means for the future is hard to say, because, you know, for example, with China, you have a very different set of political values, and the role of technology and surveillance within the Chinese state is radically different from anything that we would think of as acceptable. And so I think we are heading towards a moment of multipolarity. We're heading towards a moment where, you know, humanitarianism as a multilateral activity is more or less in decline. And that's in part because it's become so political, and it's in part because we do see a retrenchment of the idea that sort of what happens within a state's borders is its own business. And that's a very dangerous idea in my mind, because that's sort of the notion of sovereignty pre-World War II, was that, you know, a state had, you know, human rights weren't really a thing, and a state had complete power over the individuals within its territory. And, you know, so if we progress back towards that, it raises a whole host of questions about how we respond to things like complex emergencies and conflict, especially civil conflict. You know, disasters might be another story. I mean, you have the increased localization of aid, which I think is actually a very powerful tool, but it requires, of course, you know, when you look at, say, Syria again in the rebel-held territories, you had local actors trying to step up and, you know, fill the gap where aid organizations, international aid organizations, couldn't go. And of course, they became essentially targets in the conflict. And so I don't know how you deal with those complex emergencies and localization of aid at the same time, especially if you're looking at a world where, you know, human rights matter less or they're in retreat. And so I don't have an optimistic view of the future right now. You know, I also think that, and we haven't really had time to discuss, you know, the Palantir deal with, WFP, but I also think that, you know, I shouldn't just solely say that, you know, Russia and China are, you know, pushing a sort of different view of the world, but you also have, you know, organizations, like Palantir. And one of the interesting things about, you know, that's an American company, and it is, you know, the reason this uproar occurred was because they are essentially a defense contractor. The perspective of the humanitarian sector really is that they are a defense contractor and not just a tech company, which creates, of course, the perception of, you know, partiality towards U.S. interests. But what's more compelling to me, you know, I know others are doing, you know, work on this, and they'd be more sort of to sort of speak on it, but it's sort of outside of the state interests that they might represent. You know, you see the way that we as a sector engage with technology firms is very much tied to this notion of surveillance capitalism. And so you see a lot of, you know, it doesn't have to be Palantir. It could be a Google or a Facebook that we're engaging with. And that is a distinct from the sort of political values that I would say you see with China and you see with Russia, and maybe even distinct from the last sort of 70 years of sort of the Western global order. That is its own sort of political agenda that's sort of driven by a very different set of values. And that's also something that we need to be thinking about and wary of. And so, you know, these are all forces that are, I think, pushing us away from the traditional model of aid that we've sort of seen over the last 70 years. And, you know, that's probably a simplification in terms of, I don't want to describe it as monolithic, but there's this sort of Dinantist tradition. Henri Dunant was the founder of the Red Cross, which is a very humanistic, very impartial and neutral sort of notion of humanitarian aid. And a lot of it was, you know, it was humanist. It was very human centric, to a very different set of competing models that are driven by capital, technology, and the political values of multiple states at this point. And I think that's going to be an ongoing struggle that we're, as a sector, going to have to grapple with and what it means for our future. And I think that there are a lot of good, smart young people who are very much aware of these risks that are pushing the sector to have hard discussions. But I don't know that it's necessarily enough when you have a very quickly changing political environment that we need to adapt to. And also when we need to, when these are, you know, if these organizations, the international organizations, are going to survive, they're going to be sort of self-interested in the sense that they're going to, you know, essentially try to meet the needs of donor states. And that may, you know, of course, you know, the donors are going to have an outsized role in setting the agenda. And so what that means for the future when we're sort of seeing this move towards multipolarity, I'm really not sure.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Dan, and offering your really knowledgeable thoughts on this topic. It seems like it's going to be a constant struggle and constant development with technology and humanitarianism, and how the two work together or not work together, really.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for having me on the show. And I think you're absolutely right. It's an ongoing struggle as we sort of figure out the meaning of these technologies in the context of what we do, and of course sort out the politics versus the aspirational aspects of what we do. You know, there's been a huge push towards professionalization of the sector of the last 20 years, and that includes technology. But along with that has come, you know, a culture of you know, a risk culture, sort of security culture, that, you know, carries its own set of values. And so sort of trying to figure out the meaning of what, you know, those values shifting, and the sort of political milieu that in which the sort of sector exists, is going to be a constant struggle. And I don't think it's going to, you know, be something that's going to be resolved anytime soon. But I also think that, that's the, you know, you could say the same of sort of the international order right now. We're in a period of change, and we, I think, as a sector, both as humanitarians who exist to alleviate suffering, and also I would say that human rights advocates who I would make, you know, distinguish from humanitarians for a lot of good reasons, but they all, you know, this is going to keep us all very engaged as we sort of struggle to figure out what all of this means. And we, you know, struggle to advocate on behalf of, you know, humanitarian law, humanitarian aid, and human rights, depending on the discipline that you're coming from.
Well, once again, thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast and offering your wealth of information on this topic.
Thank you.